From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today we address the challenges of intimate relationships in a college setting. We'll talk with ISU sociologist Teresa Downing-Matabag about her most recent research on sexual risk-taking behavior among college students. Also, University of Northern Iowa professor Harry Brode about his new DVD project, Asking for It, The Ethics and Erotics of Sexual Consent. Then we'll talk with Jared Kuhn, who coordinates one of the state's most successful men's anti-violence programs. We'll find out about the training he does and ask whether he's seen a change in attitude about sexual assault. That's all coming up. First, this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's common for the number of sexual assaults to rise when students return to campus. Today, we talk about the challenges of intimate relationships in a college setting and how those types of relationships have changed in recent decades. Joining us, first of all, Harry Brode, professor of philosophy and humanities at the University of Northern Iowa. Harry Brode has been teaching courses in ethics and gender studies for many years. He has a new DVD project called Asking for It, The Ethics and Erotics of Sexual Consent, which offers new perspectives for date rape prevention education. Professor Harry Brode joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Cedar Falls this afternoon. Good afternoon, Professor Brode.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Your new DVD, Asking for It, makes it clear that the line of consent is not always clear. Can you tell us, describe a common situation in an intimate relationship where consent gets really, really muddy or confusing?
Well, one of the problems is people rely on what they call body language. And I think I just know what someone wants because of the way I think their body is moving. That's a very dangerous mistake. One of the things I argue for, and in fact policies and laws are increasingly moving towards, is if you want to initiate sexual activity with someone, the obligation is on the person who's initiating to be really clear that they have consent. And the best way to do that is the title of the DVD, Asking for It.
Mm-hmm. So in plain language, how does this differ from previous generations' approaches?
Well, a lot of people used to think and still do that it's up to somebody else to put on the brakes, that I have a go-ahead to try what I wish, and it's up to the other person to tell me to stop. We have switched that. The responsibility is on the person who wants to initiate some sort of activity. It's their responsibility to know they have consent. It's not the other person's responsibility to tell you, no, you don't.
Mm-hmm. You say we have switched that. To what degree have we switched that?
Well, I don't want to get overly technical here, but the legal standard is called the affirmative consent standard. And that means consent has to be conferred by some affirmation. Something has to be said. Something has to be done to create consent. You can't just assume that it's there. And increasingly, states in their legal codes, especially on college campuses, for the safety of all our students, we have moved to that standard of conduct that we're expecting from our students.
Mm-hmm. Is there a special wording that is in this new affirmation standard?
No, we're not talking about requiring signed contracts. We're not talking about bringing your attorneys into the bedroom with you. There is, no matter how strict we want to be, there is room for common sense. But we are requiring that an explicit, unambiguous affirmation be made that there is consent to what is going on.
In teaching your classes on ethics, gender studies, and you discuss these things in class, what do your students say are the most confusing areas for them and this switch, this transformation in getting consent clear?
A lot of them will come in thinking that they have the go-ahead unless somebody stops you.
Will they argue for that position?
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, they will say, you know, it's up to someone else to let me know. I have the right, if they don't say anything, I have the right to assume that the other person is okay with it. Mm-hmm. And we want to insist, no, actually, you don't have that right. We all, if you think about it, we all really believe we have the right to our own bodily integrity, our own personal space. And no one has the right to come in on you unless you've given them permission to do so.
Do you talk about or investigate the way we got to the previous set of principles where unless someone says no, the person goes forward?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of research about this. There's a sense of entitlement of access to other people's bodies. Now, I want to say the principle is gender neutral, whether it's male, female, female, male, two males, two females. One always has to take positive steps to obtain consent. But most of the problems we run into, especially on college campuses and in the larger society, when there's an accusation of sexual assault, it's usually a male initiator coming in on a female without permission. And what we're talking about is a historical sense of male entitlement of access to women's bodies. And we can get more theoretical and talk about male privilege or sexism or patriarchy or whatever your theoretical frame is, but that's a lot of what's going on.
Harry Brode is with us, professor of philosophy and humanities at the University of Northern Iowa. His latest project, a DVD project, Asking for It, The Ethics and Erotics of Sexual Consent, offers new perspectives for date rape prevention education. We want to reach out to our listeners, ask you to join our conversation. What are your thoughts about how intimate relationships have changed over the years? Have they changed for the better or for the worse? We know that they have changed when we talk about college students, people in their early 20s, late teens, and so forth. 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number. Your thoughts about how intimate relationships have changed for the better or the worse. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Let's talk a little bit about that, modern romance, if I may title it that way. Many of our listeners, Harry, are several decades beyond their early 20s.
Right. Me too.
Me too. How is the nature of intimate relationships among young people different today if I was suddenly transported so from the 1950s into the present? What would be the chief differences that I would notice in intimate relationships?
Well, my students often talk about hooking up, which are, you know, I don't want to say casual because these things have real meanings in people's lives, but there's an apparent sort of understood contract of sex without commitment. It goes by the name of freedom and liberation, but if you look deeper, you see it does plug into this male entitlement, that it's typically males who are more interested in having these sorts of relationships. Females are more interested in emotional connection accompanying physical intimacy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research about how for women, emotional and physical intimacy tends to be more connected, whereas for males, we tend to separate that. Now, I'm very careful with my language about generalizations
and
tendencies, right. but you know, because you don't want to stereotype. There are a whole bunch of people who fit into what one identifies generally as the other pattern. But as a generalization, there does seem to be something there.
Mm-hmm. But also, this hookup culture has nevertheless arisen.
Yeah.
And it has shifted somewhat, even though you say that females see it somewhat generalized, yep, differently than males do. What changed? What drove this change toward a more of a hookup culture for those who participate in friends with benefits and so on?
Nice. Yeah, I know that phrase. That phrase too. Part of it is the incredible oversaturation of media culture. With Instant gratification in all realms, whether we're talking about food and obesity epidemic, whether we're talking about politics, people going for quick fix slogans rather than thoughtful long term strategies for improving our country's serious problems. We are focused on instant gratification, corporations operating for this quarter's bottom line instead of long-term fiscal responsibility. We have all seen the catastrophe that brings. So instant gratification without thought to the future. Our culture is unfortunately really saturated with that, mm-hmm. and sex is one of the areas where we see that.
So you're talking about pop culture, for instance, Lady Gaga and the rest, how this media culture influences youth culture practices. But I'm wondering, reflections that we see in a Lady Gaga video or the rest, there's certainly more than her videos out there that have plenty of racy things in them, a reflection of the changing practices in our youth culture or a driver of the change?
It's a real good question, and the best I can say is that it's a feedback loop. These things, the media images and actual behavior reinforce each other. My general tendency, and again, this is an overgeneralization, is that the media are what economists call a lagging indicator. People change how they behave, and media reflects that back. I resist when my students bring up it's the fault of the media, because I think that that's too easy to relieve us from examining responsibility for our own behavior. It's a powerful influence, but we need to understand it's not the sole factor. It's not simply monkey see, monkey do, though the media are indeed very powerful in shaping behavior.
Talking about sexual intimacy with Harry Brode, professor of philosophy and humanities at the University of Northern Iowa, has been teaching courses in ethics and gender studies for many years. Join our conversation with your thoughts about how intimate relationships have changed for the better or for the worse, in your opinion. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, let's go to our first caller, Amanda from Nevada. Hi, Amanda, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm looking forward to reading the book. I work in a law enforcement setting, and my question is, I'm just wondering what your take is on the component of introducing alcohol to the situation. I feel like in educating some of our students on campus, a lot of times we get into a debate over can someone consent when they're under the influence, and it always comes back to, well, we were both drinking, you know, how was I supposed to know?
Mm-hmm.
When both parties are drinking or partaking
right,
in
Excellent point that we wanted to bring up. I'm glad you brought it up. Amanda from Nevada wants to know, Harry, what about drinking culture and how that affects consent signals?
Yeah. The mix of alcohol and drugs and sex is a really dangerous combination because it clouds judgment, impedes the ability to give rational consent. This is one of the virtues of shifting responsibility to the person who wishes to initiate. In this lecture that's recorded in the DVD called Asking for It, The Ethics and Erotics of Sexual Consent, I've given this lecture to, you know, live audiences over the years, and one of the noticeable reactions I get is towards the end, I say, the bottom line is if you have been initiating sexual activity when you are too drunk or high to know whether you have consent, then by definition, if somebody asks you or you ask yourself, have you ever sexually assaulted someone? The only honest answer you can give is, I don't know. Because if you're too out of control of your cognitive faculties to know that you have consent, the responsibility is on the initiator to have taken steps to have obtained knowledge that you have consent. If you've rendered yourself incapable of judging that, you don't know if you've sexually assaulted someone. And the flip side, the other part of your question, if someone is inebriated, they're not capable of giving consent.
Yeah, but that's always a matter of degree, isn't it, Professor Broad, that, you know, you can have one drink. Does it? Where is the consent? Do we measure that with blood alcohol level, or how do we know when the line has been crossed? Crossing it with one beer, one glass of wine?
This is why we have investigations. I want to sharply distinguish between the criteria we use, the questions we ask, is was the person in full rational capacities able to give consent? Then it's a factual investigation whether that level was crossed or not. But what I want to say is there are all sorts of other cases where the factual situation is difficult to determine. You promised me the job. No, you didn't. You disclosed the defect in the house I'm buying. No, you didn't. The difficulty of determining a complex set of facts doesn't prevent us from articulating the moral principle that we have to hold to, that if someone is inebriated, they can't give consent. And then, indeed, the factual investigation can become very complex.
Harry Broad is a professor of philosophy and humanities at the University of Northern Iowa. He's been teaching courses in ethics and gender studies for many years. His latest DVD project, Asking for It, The Ethics and Erotics of Sexual Consent. I want to go now to Teresa Downing. Teresa Downing Matabag, assistant professor of sociology at Iowa State University. She teaches the Sociology of Intimate Relationships class. Good afternoon to you, Professor Downing.
Good afternoon. It's good to be with you today.
Great to have you with us. Now, your most recent research, I understand, has been looking at sexual risk-taking behavior among college students. What are you looking at?
I look at the factors that students take into account when they are engaging in sexual relations with someone. And most of my research to date has involved looking at sexual risk-taking during hooking up.
Mm-hmm. And what have you found out?
Well, I found that students don't always use the best rationales for deciding whether or not they're in a risky situation. Students, for example, might decide to have unprotected intercourse because their hookup partner looks clean. One student in our interviews went as far as to say that he decided not to use a condom when he had intercourse with a woman whom he barely knew because we don't have HIV/AIDS in Iowa, or at least we don't have enough that he needed to worry about. Students were also making decisions about having unprotected intercourse based on their social knowledge of their partners. For example, one young woman talked about hooking up with somebody and having unprotected intercourse with him because she knew him from high school, and she and all of her friends knew that he wasn't the type of guy who slept around.
Mm, okay, so not really using hard facts to determine this at all.
No.
So we talked earlier about the kind of intimate relationships that are common today, have been common in, well, perhaps under the umbrella term of hookup culture, open relationships, friends with benefits, all these terms that we hear. How does this play out when it comes to addressing the problem of sexual assault? Does the fact that there is more emphasis on sexual intimacy, which I gather from this conversation, and that we have these different types of relationships, more casual sexual relationships, make it easier or harder to navigate when it comes to determining sexual assault? Teresa Downing.
Well, I think it makes it much more difficult to navigate that terrain. And indeed, a couple of the women who participated in our qualitative interview study of students who had hooked up told us stories that really involved instances of rape more than, you know, instances of active sexual consent. And I think that the sensationalization or the sexual hypersexualization actually of intimate relationships and of women in our culture, along with this increasing popularity of hooking up, oftentimes under the influence of alcohol, is making students more vulnerable to various types of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. How do we define date rape?
Date rape involves being forced or coerced into having vaginal or anal intercourse. Can also involve oral sex, i.e. involvement in these activities without one's consent.
Harry Broad, your DVD is a date rape prevention education tool. How do you go about, what are the ideas you share that we need to make people more aware of so that date rape is prevented?
Well, there's something I notice the audience typically takes to by way of opening explanation of what we're talking about. I go to what I learned in driver's ed. Given my age, we're talking about 40 years ago. My driver's ed teacher was talking about the idea of the right of way, and said the right of way is not something you have. The right of way is something the other driver gives you. And if the other driver doesn't give it to you, you don't have it, no matter what you think the rules of the road are supposed to be or what you think you're entitled to. And if people understood that, we'd have a lot fewer tragic collisions. Consent works like that. It's not something you have. It's something the other person has to give you. And if they don't give it to you, you don't have it, no matter what you think the rules are supposed to be or what you think you're entitled to. And if people understood that, we would also have a lot fewer tragic encounters.
Okay, Exchange listeners, what are your thoughts about the conversation you're hearing? How have intimate relationships changed? Have they changed for the better or for the worse? Mark is joining us from East Moline. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Mark, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Professor, you are so right on. I can't even believe that you're saying this. You must be my age. I'm 54.
I've got you by 5 years. I'm 59.
Okay, that's pretty damn close. Anyway, my point is yeah, when I wanted to pursue a female, I wanted her to like me. I didn't want to have to foist myself on her. You know, that's brutality. That's just ridiculousness. And I don't understand this hooking up stuff. I will confess, a couple of times I did have casual sex in my life, but it was not a regular occurrence, and I never thought it was very satisfying. And I'm wondering where the heart and the soul and what the ethics that you're, and I'm not being accusatory, believe me, sir, but what are the ethics that you're trying to teach, and where is the vacuum that seems to be occurring with those very ethics and this hooking up stuff in the day of age?
Okay, Mark, we have to take a break in about a minute, so I want to give time for a response. Harry Broad, please respond, and then we'll go to a break.
My view is that we do not leave our ethical selves at the door when we enter the bedroom or the boardroom or whatever it is. I don't think all is fair in love and war. The challenge is to keep our ethical selves with us no matter what we do.
Okay, we'll be back. More of our conversation about the challenges of intimate relationships in a college setting. Harry Broad is with us, professor of philosophy and humanities at the University of Northern Iowa. Teresa Downing, assistant professor of sociology at Iowa State University. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. Oh, oh, oh. Thanks for joining us on this edition of The Exchange over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio's news stream. I'm Ben Kiefer. Over the years, various slogans have welcomed people to Iowa. Fields of opportunities, a place to grow, a state of minds, the tall corn state. Remember that one? Well, tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about perceptions of Iowa both from within and outside and how best to market and brand the state. We'll also examine an effort to rebrand the Technology Corridor. That's in eastern Iowa. Tomorrow on this program, tomorrow Friday. Today, we're talking about the challenges of intimate relationships in a college setting. It's common for the number of sexual assaults to rise when students return to campus. In our first half hour, we had as a guest professor of philosophy and humanities at the University of Northern Iowa, Harry Brode, and we want to thank him for joining our conversation in that first half hour. Didn't get a chance on the way out to the last segment to do that. I want to thank Harry Brode for doing that. Still with us, Teresa Downing. She is assistant professor of sociology at Iowa State University, teaches a sociology of intimate relationships class, joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Professor Downing, reset this topic by telling us, and I asked Harry Brode this question too, if we were to take romance, intimate relationships in the 1950s and compare them with today, what would you say would be the chief differences for people in their early 20s?
Well, in the 1950s, you're talking about that post-World War II era, right, when the United States became an economic superpower. And it was very easy during that period of our history for young men to graduate from high school and go get a pretty decent job wherein they could support a family, right, have a wife, have a kids, a house with a little two-car garage in the suburbs. And during that period, we were taking relationships a little more seriously. They were actually staged. And so young people might date in groups when they first started high school, mm-hmm. for example. But then as they progressed and, you know, more towards their senior years, they started engaging in more serious dating. Mm-hmm. And they might, you know, a girl might get her boyfriend's class ring, for example, and that was a pretty big deal. And then they would move on to engagement and marriage.
And flash forward to now?
Yeah, flash forward to now. So we go from having the stage where we know what to expect to now where there is such a huge diversity in relationships. And sometimes relationships will even start with sex in the hookup culture. So you have hookups, you have friends with benefits, you have booty calls, you have serious dating, right? And you still have people who are abstinent and waiting for that right person or waiting until marriage to have sex. So I think that the relationship terrain today is a little bit more confusing for young people. And research shows that one of the most common questions for young women to ask in relationships, for example, is, what type of relationship do I have here?
Mm.
Are we dating or is this just a hookup or a series of hookups? Exactly what's going on?
Teresa Downing of Iowa State University, a sociologist. You would like to get in on our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Your thoughts about how intimate relationships have changed for the better, for the worse. Judy is joining us from Viola in Illinois. I hope I got your town's name pronounced correctly, Judy.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
I am of retirement age and had six children who went through the various stages of dating through college and all of the things attached to that. And I think one thing has not changed, and that is that women are more aware of it, that men, if they want to have a relationship with men, that sex is the first priority. And that is the difference between now and when I was growing up, is women were naive then, that not understanding that that was an expectation. And now women know it is an expectation, and they make their choices as to whether or not they want to get involved and may get involved and have sex right away to decide whether or not they want to carry on that relationship, because they know that sooner or later it's going to have to be sex or the guy is going to move on. Mm-hmm. And this has happened over and over on both sides, three daughters and three sons. These are the stories. It's just an expectation now. And so I think that part has not changed. It is still the paternalistic idea of the male, that he's entitled. Mm-hmm. And it's up to the woman now just feels free to say, okay, do you want to have a relationship or is this sex?
Okay, Judy, let's get a reaction to that observation. Is she right on, Teresa Downing, with that? Mm-hmm. The constant there is that the males are as they have always been, I guess.
yes and no. I mean, the research shows that we are having age, premarital sex, right, about as frequently now as we were back then. But now that premarital sex is more likely to be in the context of a non-committal relationship, such as a hookup. Okay. Mm-hmm. And another, I think, really interesting thing about today's culture is that some young women are actually choosing to hook up rather than have relationships. Now, it's not that the research doesn't show, of course, that women are still more interested in committed relationships than our men. Nevertheless, especially if you look at women who come from more educated families, middle to upper income families, you see that women are taking their investment in college very seriously. They're thinking about their future career trajectories. And sometimes they simply don't want to be involved in relationships where they're going to be, you know, joined at the hip with somebody, mm-hmm. when they can be out there pursuing their careers and enjoying meeting lots of different people and networking in college. And they also sometimes want that mobility to take that first job out of state if that's what it takes to launch their careers.
Okay, Judy from Viola, Illinois, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Actually, what Judy was talking about feeds right into what our next guest is talking about. Jared Kuhn is the Men's Anti-Violence Council Coordinator at the University of Iowa, joining us in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Good afternoon to you, Jared.
Good afternoon.
Tell us, what is the Men's Anti-Violence Council at the University of Iowa?
Yes, it's a volunteer opportunity at the university for men to get involved in anti-violence programming and to be part of a group that creates solutions when it comes to violence prevention.
Okay, you talk about masculinity, healthy and unhealthy masculinity. Give me first a picture of what you would define as unhealthy masculinity when it comes to intimate relationships.
Well, and your previous guest, Harry, is a pioneer in the field. And so one of the things I would think of if I was thinking of unhealthy masculinity is a rigid, inflexible system where if you don't conform to those parameters, you experience a lot of social and interpersonal difficulties. It would be things that are really black and white. There's one right way to be a man. There's one healthy way. There's one way to prove you're a man. And so it looks different. In the research, there's a lot of jargon. It's called hegemonic masculinity. And it's really this idea of a traditional masculinity where it invokes the idea of stoicism, being tough, impervious to pain, not being in touch with your emotions. That's kind of the traditional idea. When we talk about healthy masculinity today, we usually phrase it in terms of men using their strength and their leadership abilities to mentor others into becoming better people, having integrity.
So how does this reshape the male-female, or I guess this is not gender-specific, how does this reshape the interaction between two people in an intimate relationship?
Well, I think one of the really positive things is that it allows a discussion of masculine traits among individuals who identify as female and those traditionally defined feminine traits among men. And so it allows for a bit more flexibility. If we don't enforce these rigid conformities, people are allowed to be what they feel they are and who they feel that they can be in an intimate relationship. They can it can affect communications and expectations, even a discussion of consent like Harry talked about before.
Okay, let's go to our next caller, 1-866-780-9100, Don from Davenport. Good afternoon, Don. Great to have
you
with us.
Oh, yes. My name is Don, and I live in Davenport here. I'm a middle-aged gay guy, and I was just wondering, my experience here has been that maybe just kind of an internal male or gay culture, that there's just not a lot of room for the whole dating scene. And you know, sort of, I guess, just sort of an expectation that you're going to hook up. But as far as actually developing kind of a dating long-term relationship, I find that kind of frustrating. And I was just wondering if maybe your host there had any kind of feedback on whether it differs in gay culture that her experience, or it's about the same, or what.
Okay.
I guess I'll take my comments off the air.
Don, thank you for that input from Davenport. Teresa Downing, I guess he was referring to you, talking about that. Do we see a difference there between heterosexual and homosexual cultures in terms of how these relationships have been changing?
Well, I think that there's always been a greater openness in gay culture to having what we call open relationships. One of my very best friends is a gay man who lives in Colorado. And so, and through my conversations with him and also through my own research, you know, I think I've come to the conclusion that maybe that even though we tend to experience a lot of similarities, we have a lot of similarities between heterosexual dating and same-sex dating or gay dating in this case, there are also some differences. And I think that those differences are worth talking about. One of those differences is, you know, again, gay couples tend to be more open to having open relationships where each of the individuals is permitted to date outside.
So we're talking about male gay.
Yeah, male gay. Yeah, they tend to be more open to having open relationships, right, where they can date other people even though they maintain their commitments to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And also in among gay couples, especially living in more isolated, like let's say rural communities or couples who are living maybe on campus, for example, oftentimes they'll encounter situations where they know other gay men in the community, and then they have this network of gay men, and there might be a number of different types of the relationships that develop within that network, and because of that, the relationships become extremely complicated. You know what I mean? So if I'm dating someone in the network and we break up and then I start dating someone else in the network, but I'm still seeing that person I broke up with, there's going to be some jealousy and maybe some tension there
and,
in that relationship. Whereas,
And in lesbian couples, less open to open relationships?
Yeah, lesbian couples tend to be a little bit less open to open relationships, and they'll be more likely to be sexually exclusive. But nevertheless, even among lesbian circles, let's say on a campus such as ISU, for example, you might expect there to be a little more tension in the network of lesbian women simply because it's a smaller network, right, than you see among the heterosexual students on campus, for example, where there's a little more anonymity. Right? You can date someone and break up, and chances are you're not going to encounter that person very much again.
Teresa Downing is an assistant professor of sociology at Iowa State University. She teaches a sociology of intimate relationships class. Glad to have her with us this hour. And also Jared Kuhn with us, Men's Anti-Violence Council Coordinator at the University of Iowa. Jared Kuhn, before we go back to phones, and we do want to go back there before the end of the hour with more thoughts about intimate relationships, how they've changed for the better or worse, 1-866-780-9100. I want to ask about specific skills that are practiced, awareness that is raised specifically in this men's anti-violence program.
Well, part of our mission is to engage community members in understanding that violence affects too many of our residents, and it really is a community-wide issue. It's not a particular group, a particular group's issue to take up and only solely take it on themselves. And so the idea is to really engage the community members in becoming part of the solution. The idea is that we all have a voice. There's a lot of good people in our community.
Mm-hmm. So who takes part in these workshops?
Well, we've delivered workshops now in the last 2 years to over 1,500 individuals, mainly students and staff at the university. But part of our mission is to engage community members as well. And the Men's Anti-Violence Council members are made up of men from the community and the campus.
So what compels a man to go to one of these workshops? It seems to me that the very people who have the most awareness are the ones who least need this, but the most likely to come to a workshop.
Well, that's the best part of this is a new turn in prevention work. Is we're engaging bystanders. It's a minority of people in our community who are offenders. The problem is they commit the majority of violence. And when we think of the people in our communities, most of the people I meet are good people. However, progress doesn't happen when good people remain silent.
Mm-hmm.
Progress happens when people are taught the skills so that they can speak up when they encounter these things that are inappropriate or harmful.
And this is something to do when you practice bystander intervention.
That's one of our workshops, yes.
Tell us what happens in an intervention.
Well, the majority of people that I work with recognize when things are a problem. They have a feeling in their gut that this isn't appropriate. I wish this would stop. But the problem is they may not feel confident in their ability to intervene, and they may not feel that they have the skills. They don't know what to say.
So give us an example of a successful intervention.
Sure.
Sort of play-by-play a little bit.
Well, theoretically, a successful intervention would be any intervention with the intention of being helpful. The idea is you're sending a message. In our community, we don't appreciate this. We don't tolerate this. We don't treat people like that. So when you're looking at trying to intervene with somebody, the ultimate goal is you can't control their behavior. But if they feel that they have the right to say it, one of the things that motivates me is I have a right to say how it impacts me and how I interpreted it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the goals of a healthy intervention is to do something besides silence, something that engages the individuals around to critically think about what's going on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of techniques and skills.
Yeah, but it seems to me one of the problems would you wouldn't want to get someone's back up. You would want to de-escalate rather than escalate at the same time as getting a point across.
Yeah, it's not to induce defensiveness or to blame or shame somebody. It's to raise awareness.
Mm-hmm. How big of a problem is sexual assault on Iowa campuses?
Well, in general, sexual assault cases are no worse here than anywhere else that I know of, but there's too many of our students. They estimate, the research I've looked at says for every 10,000 students, there'll be about 365 rapes per 10,000 students a year.
Are you seeing any trends?
We're seeing a consistent number of cases reported. Or a consistent number of occurrences. What's promising is when more victims come forward and speak about it. That shows us we've created an environment where they feel supported and that they can receive services. And so we're seeing a lot more awareness about the issue and willingness to seek help is ultimately the goal.
Professor Downing, what do you have to add to that as far as the current picture on sexual assaults in Iowa?
I am very concerned, and I think that this is an issue that parents need to be more aware of. I think that students need to become more aware of it as well from the first day that they set foot on our college campus. The Department of Justice says that 1 in 5 college women will either be raped or sexually assaulted by the time she graduates. And college women are at higher risk of being raped or sexually assaulted than are women in the general population of the same age group. One of the things that puts college women at risk, and this gets back to the violence intervention that we were just discussing, is going to parties on campus, at fraternities, for example, or parties where there are groups of men who have decided on any given night to give young women alcohol in order to, you know, get them inebriated and have sex with them. I think that this makes young women vulnerable to date rape. Vulnerable to rape and also to gang rape. And that's an issue that I think we need to talk about more publicly.
Mm-hmm. What trends are you seeing, though? Have you seen attitudes change? We've had some programs here trying to raise awareness, develop skills. Are they having any effect, Professor Downing?
I think we need to do more evaluation on whether they are having an effect. I remember when I first came to Iowa State University and started teaching the intimate relationships class, I invited Access to come to my class and give a discussion about dating violence and sexual assault. And there were a few young men at the back of the classroom of around 80 students who were openly joking about the fact that they had just gotten some girls drunk last weekend and had sex with them. And, you know, I think I would like to know what impact the interventions that I do in my class and that are being done in other classes and on campus in general, what impact are those interventions having? I don't think we have enough research on that.
Jared Kuhn, do you have anything to say about if you've noticed attitudes changing, even if in a small step way?
Well, the research is fairly new. I mean, bystander intervention assessments, a couple years old, they've shown some promising attitude and behavioral changes for up to 6 or 9 months after workshops. But the issue is not just simply doing a one-time shot, mm-hmm. not just simply doing a lecture at orientation and never following up again. And so what I've seen anecdotally is a cultural shift in our campus of being willing to engage in these discussions. When I first started, it was a little more difficult to engage people. They were more suspicious about what we were doing and what the purpose of our work was. In the last 2.5 years, I've really seen a change in terms of the willingness of departments and organizations to invite us in and to have these discussions.
Okay, let's go quickly. If we have a quick comment from Dustin in Center Point, we have to go in just a moment. Dustin, your point you wanted to make?
Yeah, I recently just watched one of the sexual assault videos that's required to be watched by before you start going to UNI or any other public university. And you touched on this earlier with the consent and being drunk at the same time. Seems like there's somewhat of a double standard there, whereas if both the man and the woman are both intoxicated, if the woman decides in the morning that she regrets the experience, that the man automatically becomes a rapist. And it's just hard to understand why, if both parties are intoxicated, why is the woman the only one that's not giving consent? Why is that same? Why isn't the man not being? Why is consent from the? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay, Dustin, thank you very much. I'm afraid that's the end of our hour. We'll have to leave that observation without any further analysis, though we could. I wish we could have. I want to thank Jared Kuhn, Men's Anti-Violence Council Coordinator at the University of Iowa, Teresa Downing-Matabag, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Iowa State University. Thank you both for joining our conversation today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Lindsay Moon, Alex Hoyer, and Catherine Perkins. Our theme music was composed normally by Dan Knight. You hear we have something else for you today. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I want to thank Michael Yeager in Ames for helping us out today. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.